Greetings, growers of the world. Jordan River here again. It's a pleasure to grow together. Today, one of my favorite guests is back on the show, Stephen Raisner, host of Growing with Fishes, aquaponics expert, living soil expert, so much more. What a great cultivator and guest this guy is. Of course, if you're not listening to Growing with Fishes, go and subscribe. You're going to love today's episode. It's a really powerful one with the great Steve Raisner. Before we get to Steve, going to give some love to Plant Success, aka Plant Revolution. You can find them at plantrevolution.com. You've heard of them. You've seen them in your local hydro store. Pick them up. I love the king crab. You've heard me talk about it time and time again, and that's because I can recommend it to any grower because it's an extremely clean product and it applies to any setup out there. Of course, they make the granular great white myco as well as the liquid myco that is called Orca in their line. And don't sleep on the myco chum either, perfect for feeding that soil biology. You need that stimulation on the plant's immune system. We talk about that today. Plant Revolution products are perfect for exactly that. Beneficial fungi and bacteria designed to uptake more nutrients, designed to photosynthesize more effectively, and of course, stimulate that root zone to get all those expressions that you want, baby. Plant Revolution. Incorporate their products into your garden today and see the difference of microbiology. All right, everyone, let's get into it with Stephen Raisner. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to GrowCast. I'm Jordan River. Thank you for tuning in today. Before we get started, as always, I urge you to share GrowCast, spread the show, tell a grower, tell a friend. Make sure that you're spreading the show grassroots style. That's how we do it. Hit subscribe so you catch every episode. And be sure to check out patreon.com/GrowCast for hundreds of hours of bonus content, plus our Discord giveaways and so much more. Sorry, I just dropped my extract container there. Shout out to you-know-who who sent the snack pack. Thank you, my friend. Hitting on this, enjoying myself, and about to enjoy myself even more because one of my favorite guests is on the line. We have from Growing with Fishes and the aquaponics class and conference and so much more. We got Stephen Raisner on the line. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, Jordan. How's it going? Happy to be back. In fact, we had your wonderful coffee that we had saved and hadn't opened yet until we moved, and we just moved and have been drinking your coffee the last week or two. So thanks a lot, man.
My pleasure. Purity Coffee, of course. Use code River. It's, to be clear, it's not my coffee. I do create content for them. That is my only job, and I own a tiny, tiny piece of stock, and I just love those guys and their regenerative message. So I am glad that you're enjoying that, my friend. You know, I just got to say it, since you brought it up, this was not planned. But Purity Coffee did just make Inc. Magazine's Inc. 500 as the second fastest growing coffee company in the United States and the like 236th or something fastest growing company in the United States. So it's really, really cool. It's going on over there, man. I think you would really get along with those guys, Steve, and their regenerative mission.
Awesome. Yeah, it sounds like a great group. You've talked about them quite a bit before and it sounds like a really neat group of farmers.
Well, it's cool because Purity is also going to buy their own farm and start doing their own regenerative research and seeing how that affects, for instance, different health compounds in the coffee. And you're a traveling guy. In fact, that's kind of where I want to start today, your upcoming travels. And they're probably going to buy this farm down in Colombia, where I was down visiting with some of the other farmers that we're currently working with. And I don't know, man, that sure would be a dream of mine, having you fly down to Colombia, meet us down there, go tour the regenerative coffee farms, meet Francisco and Oscar, the farmers. That would be pretty dope, man. I'm just saying.
Yeah, that'd be great. I have some other friends down there. Maybe we could do a tour of that and some other cool farms down there as well. It'd be kind of fun.
That would be so fun. But your travel schedule is booked already. Oh, yeah. You've got quite an adventure planned. Can you talk about your upcoming travels?
Sure, yeah. So I'll be off to Puerto Rico here in a couple of weeks, working on a big, pretty large aquaponic cannabis project there. That'll be my second aquaponic cannabis project down there. Previously worked with another group before Maria hit. And they actually had the shipping containers that were on the outside of the facility roll through the greenhouse and basically wrap the framing around the shipping containers from the high winds. So needless to say, their operation isn't running anymore. But we're excited to get back down on the island and getting back to the Caribbean, even though it is maybe not the best time of year to visit there, is a nice break after the pandemic and all the craziness that's been going on. So looking forward to that. And then come back, and then we'll have BizCon, which is the biggest biggest conference. Anyone that knows cannabis technology loves to go out there and hang out and see all the cool new gizmos and gadgets for the next year. So that's always fun. And then I'll be off to South Africa working with Sweetwater Farms over there in South Africa on their large-scale aquaponic cannabis and living soil operations there. And we'll even be teaching some classes. We have some super cool people that we'll be also teaching with from the United States regenerative scene over in South Africa while I'm there, which we haven't done announcements yet, but definitely look forward to that when we're able to announce that publicly. So we've got lots of different cool things going on for the winter. And then, you know, who knows what'll happen after that.
That's killer, man. So we're going to be enjoying the snow and you're going to be out in Cape Town or Johannesburg kicking it. That's really cool, man.
Oh, yeah. We'll be working. There's a group out by Cape Town, another group out on the eastern side of the country as well, out by south of East London, down there, further down the coast. So it'll be a lot of fun. And, you know, Africa's great. I really had a great time when I was over there before. Only really came back because of the, you know, the plague outbreak. So, you know, now that things are kind of settling down quite a bit, you know, I'm kind of excited to get back to the normal schedule of things, you know.
Well, I know you'd worked with Sweetwater before. I don't recall if you've brought up the Puerto Rico side quite yet, but how does that work? I mean, do these folks get into aquaponic farming, cannabis or otherwise, and then go, you know, what kind of consultant can I hire? And there's kind of so few of them out there with your type of extensive knowledge, they end up reaching out to you cold. Like, how does this usually work?
Sure. So a lot of the people that clients I work with on the consulting side end up, a lot of times are students from my courses. They hear on different social media platforms or podcasts and things. They hear some of the talks that I give, or maybe they see a seminar that I give at one of the in-person events, and then you know, find me that way. And then the other way we get a lot of people is also through the Aquaponics Association. They have their conference right before BizCon this year. So that's another great way that I find in a lot of other growers as well. And then you do have some people that are just aquaponic growers that would, you know, have a passion for it, know how much it increases the flavor of their vegetables because they've done side by sides with those. And they, you know, they're trying to get the cannabis side of things going. They see it as a more profitable way for them to capitalize on the facility that they've already spent money to build. And, you know, they're looking for ways to adapt it. And there's a lot of different people out there that have, you know, tried different things and not been successful. And, you know, I've had, you know, success at facilities on multiple continents working with clients. So, you know, they look at kind of the different facilities that are up and running and you know, kicking up sales and really helping push the way in terms of regenerative and sustainability, especially in areas that are more water restricted. It's very lucrative. You know, there's a group and I was working with out of Barbados before the St. Vincent volcano went off. And they decided to just wait and see when that dies down before they put any more investment into it. But there's quite a few different areas that have extremely limited total water per year, where this really is the best way for them to produce medicine for that population. You know, Barbados gets, you know, only so many inches of rain per year, and that's it. There is no fresh water sources on the island.
Wow.
Because of where it is. So they have to have the ability to recirculate that water and hold onto that water as long as possible. So by utilizing that plus, you know, maybe an indexing valve type setup for aquaponics or even a DWC that's completely covered allows them to really hold onto that water as much as possible and to, you know, make the most use of it. Because if they straight just did water in the soil or drained to waste, there simply is not enough fresh water to supply the population with enough cannabis and vegetables there. Just there isn't.
Jeez, man, that is so fascinating. I'm always enamored with your world travels. We're going to get right into cannabis cultivation in just a second. And of course, everybody go tune in and subscribe to Steve's podcast, Growing with Fishes. Check out the aquaponics cannabis course. Use code GROWCAST at apmjclass.com. Did I get that right?
Yep, absolutely. Yep. And then I keep your discount on the class and helps both of us out at the same time. So definitely, if you're looking to take the longer form class, definitely use that code to save yourself some money and help out two great producers of content.
Appreciate you, man. And of course, go and look that up if you're in the least bit interested, because that class is so extensive. I've seen it myself. It's really, really cool, you guys. And we will get into cannabis, I promise, in just a minute here. But of all these places you visited, man, like, which ones were the most kind of impactful? Like, which ones do you look back on the most fondly? Which cultures did you connect with the most? Which cannabis cultures were the most surprising or resonated with you the most?
So I had a blast both in Jamaica and then up in Nyanga in Zimbabwe. Both of those two places were kind of almost equal in my opinion, because they were just old school Rastafarians that did everything organic. They had never been exposed to any other type of way of growing. How they approached all the different types of things when it came to growing was interesting. One of the other funny things that the guys in Nyanga were talking about was how the Mambas seemed to really like the super high terpy, super sticky weed. And they thought it had to do with them being able to get the bugs off of them, because they noticed those snakes that come through into the cannabis tend to have a lot less ticks and stuff on them. So I thought that was kind of an interesting observation. Wow. That snakes were using the resin from the cannabis to kind of get bugs off of themselves. Anyways, I thought that was kind of funny. So they're like, yeah, if you have really good weed, then you get the snakes in it. And I thought that was an interesting metric to rate your cannabis.
How many Mambas, though? I mean, you can talk about THC percentage all day, but did it attract Mambas?
I never saw anyone else in Nyanga. I only saw one Mambo the whole time I was out there, and that was on our farm out in Kadoma. Ooh. And there was kind of one area where he just kind of stayed. He had a big termite mound and a big tree there, and that was his space, and everyone just avoided the whole area.
He's a renter. He's a tenant.
Oh yeah, he's a freeloader. I think is more of the
squatter,
the appropriate term. But you know,
dirty squatter.
And there's lots of them, and like the other thing that you have to remember, like especially in South Africa and Zimbabwe, if you're going into a greenhouse or any area where there's lots of plants, one, it's a good idea to bring a dog or something like that that can smell the snakes beforehand, and two, you have to wear sunglasses or eye protection because you have spitting cobras. We had two different species of spitting cobras there in Zimbabwe. And when we're down in South Africa, we have more than that. So that's the number one thing to be afraid of in terms of, like, there's not a lot of stuff that's just going to immediately strike you that you have to worry about that you're not going to otherwise normally see, but maybe some of the other stuff. But that's the biggest one that we were always afraid of in terms of you could actually like bend over to look at a bud and not see it and get spit on. You know what I mean?
Whoa. And what happens when you get spit on in the face? Obviously, you don't want your eyes to wear those sunglasses. Is it venom? Yeah. Does it get in your mouth, or is it like fucking acid or what?
Oh yeah. So it's usually not like lethal, but it can give you permanent blindness and things like that. So you definitely want to avoid it for those reasons.
Holy fuck, man. That's crazy. That's so cool. Zimbabwe. I've heard so much from Purity team members who lived there and farmed coffee there. But yeah, all of the African regions sound amazing, but Zimbabwe specifically.
If you're looking for a great place to tour and see lots of wildlife and not have to worry about being, you know, robbed or any of the stuff that a lot of people are kind of traditionally afraid of when they think of some of the faraway places they haven't experienced, Zimbabwe is one of the nicest and safest places that you can go to in terms of that. Under the previous administration, he kind of took away most of the weapons in the population. So they're, you know, you're not going to get held up, you know, in the middle of the country randomly, because there just aren't really that many weapons in the country. So it's kind of a very safe country and a very beautiful country. A lot of the wildlife there has been kind of left alone for a very long time. So at least since the early 2000s. So, you know, there is kind of an incredible amount of wildlife and especially on the northern part of the country, Manipools is an absolute magical place to visit. I mean, you can have animals and stuff running through your camp at night around your tents and stuff like that, which is a little unnerving, but also really cool at the same time. I've never seen, you know, an area that was that wild as northern Zimbabwe.
Jeez, man. I do love talking about travel, man. It's one of my deepest passions, but we are on Growcast here. So let's get into where are we going first. We'll be right back with Steve. Before that, AC Infinity. AC Infinity makes everything you need now, and you can use code GROWCAST15 to save 15% site-wide. Be sure to send us snapshots of any code you use, especially those AC Infinity codes, but any code you use, send us a snapshot and be entered to win free seeds every single month. It's a contest we do for you code users. AC Infinity is a great place to get in on that because they sell the best fans in the game. I wouldn't recommend any other fans. And now they're making extremely sexy and thick and durable tents as well. They've got the new lights that just dropped. You guys go check out the AC Infinity lights. They look sick. They've got the Samsung diodes. They look different than any other lights out there. And I think they even have an on-screen readout. So cool what's going on at AC Infinity. They're really becoming your one-stop shop for everything you need. Tents, lights, fans, pots, scissors, glasses, ratchet hangers, and more. GrowCast15 saving you 15%.
Go and get it, everybody. Use those codes, send us those screenshots, and enjoy the best. AC Infinity, GrowCast15.
All right, let's get back with Stephen Reisner, everybody. Well, I wanted to talk to you about environment. I have aquaponics questions, of course, that we're going to get into. But this kind of came up because I wanted to get your take on it from an overall perspective and then see if it differs in aquaponics. Like if that system means any sort of differences need to be adjusted to or made. So we were talking about the environment's effect on plant health and specifically nutrient uptake. And let me frame this up for you, kind of how we were talking about it on the member podcast. A lot of the time we see people posting in our plant problems Discord or on social media or what have you. And for instance, we're looking at a plant that is overwatered and the new growth yellows, looks just like a phosphorus deficiency. In fact, I've had guests say that plants cannot absorb certain minerals like phosphorus when the soil is oversaturated. I also know that plants get stressed when you stress them with those different types of stressors. But the point is, people will go, what can I add? You know, like this looks like a sulfur deficiency. Let me go ahead and water again and add sulfur. And a lot of the times you need to kind of back up and take a look at the other factors, your lighting, your temperature, your soil saturation to fix that problem instead of just having to add more minerals. I wanted to get your take on that and then see how and if that applies when you're talking about an aquaponics system, which is a little bit different than that.
Sure. So I guess the first part of it is I'm real confused as to how sulfur is going to do anything to fix that issue other than maybe kill off pythium or try to prevent pythium through sulfur is really the only thing I can even think of on that. But if you were trying to address that, one, just let the thing dry out more.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but that was kind of my point, which is that is the incorrect method would be to add more nutrition, whereas you need to fix the underlying issue. I hope I was clear about that.
Okay, yeah. So if I was doing a SIP system or something like that, to me, that would mean that my soil mix is not aerated enough and I want to go with a more aerated soil mix or maybe even put an airstone underneath my SIPs system if I was doing kind of a cracky method or a SIPs or a wicking bed type system. Again, you're not getting enough oxygen in the root zone, so that's going to cause that. You know, again, the addition of proper liquid IMO and lactobacillus is going to also help mitigate some of the negative impacts of that. But in aquaponics or hydroponics or DWC, the plant kind of adjusts its internal pressures. It has its own kind of, for simplified terms, because I can't remember the exact term they use it for plants, kind of like the blood pressure of the plant, right? So the plant's going to adjust that based on the water availability. So when it has infinite water availability, it's going to kind of have a different way that it manages water than if it has soil, right? Where it's going to have kind of that ebb and flow. This is why, for instance, if I take a DWC plant and put it in soil, it usually drops between 25 and 50% of its leaves before it fully adjusts and, you know, is able to adapt to the soil. It stresses the plant out quite a bit. So, wow. You know, if the plant's used to that from a clone or from seed, the plant's going to have a much easier time dealing with the higher water. It's not going to have the down claw and all that. But also, that's also, you know, reliant on the fact that your dissolved oxygen is above 5 parts per million, ideally for cannabis. In lettuce, you can run it as low as like 3, but you can run it lower than that, but it's not too good to do that. And that also plays a role too with water temperature, right? So if your water temperature is too high, the total possible dissolved oxygen is going to be much lower than if you have a lower water temperature. That's why, you know, a lot of people talk about chillers for DWC and things like that, because that water can get overly warm over time. Or we use heat exchangers often in large scale aquaponic facilities where we have, you know, a big giant metal heat exchanger that's sitting in one of the sumps or one of the other areas that has a lot of water volume, or even a set of coil tubes sometimes as well that'll be recirculating down into the ground with a big giant coil loop system that's usually 3 or 4 times longer than what's inside the greenhouse or even longer than that. And that allows for the heat to bleed off from the water into the ground or vice versa, right?
Wow.
So in the wintertime, I can use that to keep the place above 58 degrees. In the summertime or the water temperature, we can start at 58 so that I don't have to, you know, start off lower than that, which is great. And then in the summertime, it helps cool that, you know, work as a heat exchanger. Same thing with water heaters. We'll do the same thing with solar water heaters. running them in reverse at nighttime in the summertime as coolers, and then in the wintertime as straight heaters. So the temperature of the water and the root zone is going to also play a factor in the oxygen availability, because remember, you know, on the actual roots themselves is kind of a thin film of water where a lot of these microbes are living, and the dissolved oxygen potential of that is dependent upon the temperature of that root zone.
So I guess that kind of leads back to my original point, which is, this is what I've been told. And again, the kind of hack of DWC, or the cocoa growers will say, that's why we grow the way we do. But, you know, I've been told that there's no such thing as really oversaturation. It's the deprivation of oxygen in that root zone. And do you agree that that example, for instance, or, you know, temperatures being off or things like that, your plant looks sick, and growers can often think that they resemble a nutrient deficiency, for example, when in reality it's something else you need to correct. You know what I mean?
Well, and certain temperature, you know, when you get really high temperatures, it does affect the uptake of certain nutrients.
Right, increases it, right?
Okay, so if you have the plants at higher temperatures and the right VPD and the root zone is kept at a lower temperature, then yes, the plants will grow faster than you've ever seen them grow. In fact, you know, you put the plants at like 92 degrees with 85% humidity in a greenhouse, a lot of people would cringe hearing that, but you'll never have faster growing plants, and the plants will do just fine as long as your silica and your calcium is dialed in. You're not going to have any mold issues. In fact, we do it all the time in aquaponics. It's one of the benefits of having aquaponic systems is that we naturally have a little bit higher base humidity levels. So we tend to always run them in the 70s and 80s, you know, mid 70s to upper 80s. In most of the greenhouses that we're running, or even low 90s in the summer,
wow,
because we can take advantage of it and we can hold that VPD perfectly in range and we don't have any issues. I mean, and we absolutely benefit from it. The downside is that you can have too much oxygen in the water. So you have too much oxygen in the water, it can negatively impact your microbial replication. It can also negatively impact your a lot of your nutrients, right? So your things like iron will become oxidized at a much faster rate. So you're going to add a lot more iron typically over the course of a grow run than you would if you had it perfectly in range. So if I run my dissolved oxygen at like, you know, 8 to 12 parts per million, that's ideal. But if I ran it at like 14, 16 or 20 or something even higher, granted, you'd have to have pretty cool water to get it, you know, super high. But if you were running cool water and had a super high DO, or otherwise, you know, used oxygen injectors or some other way to boost it above normal range, you'll absolutely burn through your iron, because your iron is chelated in order to not oxidize. Because remember, the plants need an Fe2, not Fe3. So that extra oxygen is going to help break that down faster and basically cost you more money per run on that iron, as well as, you know, if you're getting to those levels, you're probably injecting oxygen, which is not cheap. In fact, most of the aquaculture guys I know, because of how much the price of oxygen has skyrocketed due to the plague outbreak, all the aquaculture guys that I know that have oxygen setups currently are not using them because of the expense.
Man, that is very interesting. Like you said, probably not a lot of people running into that, but still super fascinating, the balance being thrown off by any number of things. But I also want to focus in on what you said about temperature. You know, a lot of the times you'll hang a grower will hang a probe in their tent and that's their temperature. But that's a very good point. You take a look at the canopy temperature, you take a look at the temperature down by the root zone, and then you take a look at the temperature of the water that you're putting in. Can you kind of focus in on those and tell us what you think the perfect water temperature is, for instance, and why?
Sure. So the best water temperature is going to be between 68 to 70, at least for aquaponics and what we're doing. That gives us the best microbial replication rate and the best mineralization rates. With the highest oxygen levels potential. So kind of is that sweet spot. Now, you know, we could run it a little bit cooler and get slightly slower growth, like 66 degrees, something like that, Fahrenheit. But if we do that, we tend to sacrifice a little bit of a growth speed. So, but we do get a little bit higher dissolved oxygen. So if we have traditionally problems with Pythium or root rot or some other issues aside from dosing with microbes, we might also run a little bit cooler on that to help prevent that. Wow. Especially in if we're running NFTs, that seems to be where we really have the issues, is doing clones and NFTs more than anything else. As far as the upper part of the plant goes, really I try to keep the surface temperature around 88 degrees, 86, 88 degrees Fahrenheit on the leaf surface temperature. I take a laser thermometer and just laze the room, and then drop the lights down a little bit more if I need to, or, you know, otherwise adjust the climate control depending on if those lights are already set at the right height or not. But just making sure that everything's dialed in that way, again, that's going to help with that proper osmotic pressure in the leaves, making sure that you have the stomata, making sure that the stomata have the right pressure and everything that they need to properly breathe right and get their proper gas exchange along with the CO2 and all that. You know, if you have your temperature and your nutrients pumped in, the next limiting factor, and your lights dialed in, the next limiting factor is going to be CO2. So making sure your CO2 is dialed in as well is going to be, you know, that other factor with VPD. VPD is air movement and, you know, temperature and humidity, but also light and CO2. You know, if you're trying to really dial in all those factors, are going to be just as important to dial in with that VPD in order to hit those perfect growth rates.
Yeah, and I understand that range and needing to be in that range for the exactly for the growth rates. But I often find myself like kind of stumped when talking to certain guests, where it's like, is there even a single ideal temperature? And let me explain what I mean by that. I guess it depends on two things primarily in my view, which is like your goals and then also your cultivars. So like, for instance, if you want those crazy colors, that temperature swing is important to you. And if you don't, that temperature swing probably isn't important to you. And then furthermore, the one that really stumps me is I'm like, well, then what if you're not monocropping? Don't different cultivars, for instance, I've told guests prefer a slightly different amount of light. And they'll be like, oh yeah, well, that's a thing. Different temperature or humidity, that might be a thing. So I don't know your thoughts on those differences, if they're minimal at best or what.
Yeah, when you definitely see that with things even in outdoors in Oklahoma, you have not a lot of stuff really likes it when it gets 105, 110, but the sativas and you're out, you know, especially the African sativas or equatorial sativas, they're loving it, man. They're growing, you know, faster than they do the whole rest of the season.
That's pretty cool.
All that stuff. So making sure that you have cultivars that are adapted, at least on the outdoor setting, for your stuff. And then, yeah, like you're saying, if you do want to push the anthocyanin production, making sure your molybdenum is in a mildly toxic setting. So like dosing it up to 0.5 parts per million, 0.5 parts per million in your root zone is going to help overexpress that anthocyanin, as well as that temperature swing, just to induce that anthocyanin production. And that tends to be more in your, traditionally quote unquote indica leaning strains, right? You know, your Kushes and all that. Whereas your sativas tend to be a little bit more, you know, heat loving.
I don't want to interject here, but I may be repeating myself with this question. What is your preferred molybdenum input?
Sure. So I usually use sodium molybdenate just because it's the easiest to come by, and you can spend like $12 and it'll last most people the rest of their lifetime.
The straight stuff, uncut.
A lot of people still buy bottles and stuff from the store, and it's great if you're just getting started. You don't know how to formulate your stuff. But once you kind of get to a certain scale, like, it's kind of insane if you're running like a big operation to be buying like 55-gallon drums of hydronutrients, right? It's just kind of crazy. It's easier just to buy the powders and mix up your own and make your own formulations on site. It's just much, much easier.
Holy crap.
You're seeing a lot of companies doing that too. You know, Moore is a company out there that does microbes and stuff like that. And they have brewers on site. You're seeing a lot of other companies now starting to move towards that for the commercial grow side, where people can kind of brew their stuff on site without having to,
transport. Yeah. Transport it. Yeah. Weigh all that water and on a truck scale somewhere halfway across the country. We just had Brendan. Thank you for recommending him on the show from Moore. BioCat Solutions and Spectrum King and all that. Great episode, man. Really strong episode. And yeah, that's exactly right. That does make sense. But even so, even with the goofy bottled nutrients, and honestly, damned if they do, damned if they don't, right? If they make a different part for each input, they get smashed for too many parts because it's probably going to be impractical and too expensive. And then if they make their blends, well, then it's like, I can't even add calcium without adding magnesium and nitrogen. So they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah. And you know, we kind of had that problem. It was one of the weird things I had to kind of learn when I was working at Aquaponics Source early on, trying to figure out the different nutrient levels and different things, was that a lot of people just don't really care about knowing. They just want to buy the answer that works to fix the problem, and that's it, right? There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, sure. They're not all wizards like you, Steve. Some people only have a limited time to grow and all things like that. And we go deep in cannabis because we love it and it's our lives. But you're right. Sure. That's not for everybody.
or for newer growers. You know, hey, when we all got started, it'd be a lot easier if we just had a simple solution just to get the plant to finish so that we can learn all the different pieces.
So true.
And then we can make it more complicated as we go along. And that's often what I suggest to people when they're just getting into aquaponics is, hey, you can either, you know, get the stuff from us, or you can get the stuff wherever you want to. Here's the information on that, and kind of give you the answers on that. But as you go along, kind of move into more complicated fish, move into more complicated plants.
More complicated fish. Sounds like a psychological breakdown.
Well, think of it this way. So a great example of this would be for aquaponic cannabis facilities that are commercial, right? So the licensures for exotic fish import export is really cheap. It's like $175 a year. If you want international, it's like $1,500 a year or $1,200 a year, which is nothing compared to the rest of the stuff you're paying for your cannabis licensing. Mm-hmm. And I can now sell my stuff to anybody else that's a pet store or a landscaper or anything else in the country. I can resell butterfly koi, a fish I purchased for between $1.25 and $2. I can resell for $40 to $120 after a year.
Wow.
So that gives me a much better price point, you know, especially if I do a little bit of mix sorting on them. I can get really good return on those fish and help actually bring some extra money in the door to help pay some bills, or maybe give the guys a bonus or whatever, you know, pay your trimmers more. No, we won't do that.
No, I know what you mean, that fish money. You're talking about that sweet, sweet fish money.
Oh, yeah. Plus, also remember that until they change the scheduling on THC, it's still Schedule 1, meaning I can't apply for a meat processing license and actually kill the fish on site and sell the fillets. It's illegal. So because we can't apply for a medical or a meat processing license because of the federal legality still. So until that changes, the meat inspectors is not allowed to legally step foot in my facility. So we have to have some other way of selling those fish in a legal manner. And that usually means a pet trade license.
Very, very interesting, man. The flavors and aromas in cannabis that's grown aquaponically, Steve attests, off the charts. What about the flavors of the fish? The fish that comes out, is it like particularly delicious?
Sure. So it really depends on the feed, right? So if we feed them, one of the things that we've kind of figured out over time is feeding them, you know, insect-based protein helps out significantly with improving flavor and making them taste more like a wild type fish. So by feeding them things like dubia hissing cockroaches or soldier fly larvae or some of the other more chitin heavy insects, tends to really, really boost that flavor more than anything else. But making sure you have the right feed is really what's important for making sure that your fish tastes good more than anything else.
Wow, man. I'm glad I asked that question. You feed them insect.
Diversifying feed as well. I know we're almost all the facilities that I'm working with now, they're making labs on once or twice a week on site at pretty large volumes for their aquaponic systems. So we're taking the curds off of that and feeding it to the fish as well, because it's protein and fat. You know, it's really good for them, and it helps just with any types of issues with them banging and beating on each other a little bit. There's no kind of issues as far as, you know, there's this active microbe that loves to feed on the secondary infections like fungal infections on fins and things like that, get immediately obliterated by the lactobacillus in the water anyway.
Jeez,
so it kind of has two birds, one stone.
Curd fed is what you're telling me?
Oh, yeah.
Curd fed. Damn, sounds delicious. Sounds marbled. I got a couple aquaponics, just random questions. Can I fire them at you?
Sure.
What does a PPM usually look like? Does it change when you're talking about the aquaponic feed? I know that's a dual root zone, so they're sitting in living soil too, which probably provides a lot of the nutrition. But what is the PPM of aquaponic juice, aquaponic water?
Sure. So most of the time we're running between 400 and 600 total parts per million in our aquaponic system. It's really, really low parts per millions. But the most of the time we don't look at it in total parts per million. What I do is I get a water report and it shows me the calcium, the potassium, the phosphorus, the nitrogen, the ammonia, the chloride, the, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we look at those numbers individually and make minor adjustments around that in the base water. And then in flour and veg, we kind of have a set formula for top feeding that we can either go heavier on for heavier feeding cultivars or back off on for stuff that doesn't want to feed quite as heavy. You know, things like wedding cake and stuff like that really want to be, and a lot of your cookie hybrids really, really want to be fed super heavy to get them to plump up, right? And if you don't feed them heavy enough, they just won't pack on that weight. So that gives us the ability to kind of adjust for those cultivars in the system. You know, we can have 8 different cultivars and that can just feed that one strain a little bit heavier and it's no big deal. We just set up the manifold for that one individual cultivar. Each cultivar we usually set up with individual manifolds so that, you know, we can feed them individually. And then we just send that from the feed tank for top dressing and it feeds everything individually without anything getting messed up that way.
That doesn't surprise me that it's a lower number. And I know it works differently with the organic type inputs, right? Like those numbers are usually lower and a slower breakdown or whatever. So I'd imagine primarily that PPM in the water comes from what the fish are doing. That's primarily fish poop and stuff like that. It's not so much things you've added.
It happens to do with the microbes. Remember that they did a big study. NASA did a big study where they tried to look at different aquatic microbes versus terrestrial microbes for bringing off world. And they found that, I can pull up the name of the paper if somebody really wants to know it. But the Aquaponics Association put together the paper because they used it as part of their defense for maintaining organic certification as well. But they found that on aquaponic systems have 168% more biodiversity in terms of species than most soil systems, even living soil systems. So we have significantly more biodiversity, which is why we have more flavor, because you have more things stimulating the plant's immune system, which creates more secondary metabolites, which creates more terpenes, flavonoids, phenols, and other types of things.
All the good stuff that we're after.
Yeah. But how I like to explain it is that, okay, so look, if I have a chef and I put him in a food truck, he can do maybe 5 people to 7 people every 10 minutes or so, right? Or maybe 15 minutes. So think of the chef as like the nutrients and the customers as like the plants, okay? So that would be like a hydroponic type setup where you have, you need a lot of chefs to feed a lot of people or a lot of plants, right? So it's not very efficient. I can take that same chef and then give him a sous chef, a prep chef, waiters, waitresses, a bartender, bus boys or bus people, whatever they're called these days. and they're much more efficient. Now that same chef can do 25, 30 people in that same period of time. Those microbes would kind of be like those other employees in the restaurant. They increase the efficiency of the nutrients getting to the plant so that it's more efficient. They're able to get it into the plant and into the plant's systems faster than by having that. So it's kind of a good real world analogy for people to kind of wrap their heads around, you know, how that all connects.
Fascinating, man. And that doesn't surprise me, the increased diversity there. And it was cool talking to Brendan from Moore as well, talking about the number of microbial species in his product and why he's like the more the merrier argument, certainly solidly placed in that camp. Very interesting stuff. What were some of my other questions? The PPM. Oh yeah. Does it ever drop below that 400 mark? And how do plants finish out in aquaponics as far as the senescence process? You know, I'll say plants in DWC, they seem to finish differently. And I don't know if it's the constant nutrition. You feel me? And then plants in organic soil, when they really senesce out, I really like that. How much senescence occurs in aquaponics?
Sure. So part of the thing that you have to remember when plants are finishing off is that, you know how it drops the fan leaves that it doesn't need anymore? Well, it's also starting to shut off sections of the root system as well. That's why if you have kind of an overly overzealous root system, you can actually end up with a little bit of issues right at the end. In fact, we had that with the first couple of times we were doing wicking beds until we kind of figured out the right balance on the soil mix and the microbes. You know, we were getting kind of wilt right at the end from that problem. But with aquaponics, we generally just drift down the nitrogen significantly. So we'll start off maybe at 30 parts per million nitrates and drift down to 5 parts per million at the end, just to try and get those plants to finish up a little bit faster.
Oh, nice.
Try and help induce that. And it helps improve the flavor as well, reducing nitrogen. If you run your nitrates, especially in particular, nitrates over ammonia higher, and anything above about 30 or 40 parts per million in flower, it'll actually fluff out your buds and create more of an airy, less dense bud and really stretch the nodes on the plants and really reduce your total yields. But it can be good if you're trying to do something more hashy in a more humid environment. You can use that to open the plants up a little bit and try to reduce those more dense colas. I know that I've seen a lot of people this year in particular that had never really grown outdoors before that got a whole bunch of runts cuts because runts was super popular in the spring and a lot of people were selling clones. And I've gone to 3 separate farms now that are just covered in botrytis.
Ooh.
Like the worst botrytis you've ever seen, because those buds are super dense There's no aeration in them. The plant is not remotely adapted to the climate here. And you have these ultra, ultra dense bud structures that have no airflow in them for weeks on end. And it's humid here, right? So they're just, it's not adapted for it. And they're just losing, you know, huge sections of fields because they didn't take the right time to put the right probiotics out there. And then again, you know, doing a little bit of pheno hunting and cultivar hunting in a new area that you haven't grown in before is critical. I mean, it's the difference between success and failure, especially into year two. You know, you should be growing a whole bunch of different testers that first year, seeing what grows well there, and then capitalizing on that. I think it's something that people really do not do enough of. That and people holding on to moms way too long that are clearly have some type of chronic issue because they, you know, went to some grow cup or something, or were given it by a certain person or whatever, you know, some backstory that makes it special to them. Just trash it. There's too many other strains out there. You know, I watch people spend thousands of dollars or even like 80, 85% of their IPM budget on one cultivar. Like, why? I just do not understand that. It's one of the things I keep seeing over and over, especially this year.
You know, it's a really fascinating point. We just had a breeder feature with Predicative Breeding, and he was talking about, he said something that really seems to be the opposite of a lot of breeders out there nowadays, including some breeders that I really like. But basically, he's like, I'm not super concerned with, you know, a certain flavor profile or the hotness, this or that. He's like, I'm looking for plants that are extraordinarily hardy and grow well and are suited to the environments that I'm looking for. Basically what other agricultural sectors do. And he's like, I still find fire. You know what I mean? But that kind of is a nod towards what you were saying a second ago, which is everybody's so concerned with the trichome density and the flavors, guilty as charged. But what you're saying is, you know, look for ones that fucking are going to grow well in your environment. Look for ones that are suitable for your space. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. It's the number one thing I see farms do wrong, aside from just not having a total game plan or total farm plan, is proper hierarchy with the employees in terms of who needs to direct what, you know, is that they do not spend enough time pheno hunting. They try to grow whatever's popular instead of what's going to really grow well in their area.
Wow.
Maximize that and make something cool of your own, or find cultivars that are already popular that will excel where you're at. I mean, in Oklahoma, for example, Durban Poison and crossed with pretty much a wide range of different stuff does really well here. A lot of your equatorial stuff, like your Jamaican stuff, does really well here. A lot of your Colombian stuff does really well here because it's adapted to the heat and the higher humidity. Now, I think that you're going to see kind of and it's one of the more underserved areas with the cultivar side of things in the market, is that there aren't a lot of high heat, high humidity cultivars that are really good for people growing in the South. You know, it really is an area that there isn't enough of, and there really needs to be a lot more of in terms of development, because there's going to be a lot of farmers wanting to grow in this area. It's traditionally a very large farming area. These are very, you know, skilled farmers that know all the insects, they know the climate, they know their soil really well, but they don't have kind of material, you know, biomass and plant material to work with yet. And I think that that's really something that we need to work more towards, especially in the South. I'd love to see the Oklahoma growers kind of have like kind of a Oklahoma approved, you know, strains that are, you know, kind of climate approved, or, you know, they've been grown for three or more seasons in Oklahoma, so we can say that these are relatively adapted. I think that you're going to see more of that across the South. And hey, you know, the South loves to be proud about stuff. I can totally see them doing, you know, Oklahoma proud or Texas proud. Well, you know, maybe not the right week for that one, but Louisiana proud or Mississippi proud or one of the others.
I know what you mean, man. I would love to ask you this question. If you don't have answers off the top of your head, I totally understand. What cultivars have you experienced that have grown well in which extreme climates? I know you said in generalities, like, you know, sativas doing well in heat or things like that. But like, what if someone said, I'm in a cold environment? Do you have a strain or a certain few cultivars or lineage that you would recommend?
Yeah. So if you're dealing with cold environments, I would look at stuff that has fast finishing times. So look at like Canadian stuff, anything from BC, or anything from, you know, that's traditionally grown up there. I'm trying to think of anything off the top of my head that immediately comes to mind.
I know that's a good point, though. Going up north, like to Jay of the Islands or one of those, Saskatchewan, that one guy who breeds up there. That's a good point.
Yeah, you know, those are where you're going to have those fast finishers, because remember, they got to get everything in by like September 15th or they're toast. You know, they got about a week left to harvest, before they're really looking at, you know, staring down the barrel. In fact, I think some of those places are even going to get snow this week. So you really have to be careful with that. So I would look at those types of things because you are going to have, if you're in an area that gets colder, you're going to have that, you know, quicker finishing up in the fall. The other thing I would look at is look at cultivars that are, you know, high in anthocyanins, so your purple strains. Traditionally, those are all much more cold tolerant, you know, in general. Anthocyanin, the purple compound, is actually a type of antifreeze for the plant. So it will help, that compound specifically helps reduce ice crystals in the plant xylem and phloem. So, wow. You know, definitely something to think about as well when you're looking at a cultivar selection. And then look at more dense, more compact plants. Those are going to do better. And then also, if you're at higher latitudes, which is usually where you are, or low, ultra low latitudes, if you're on the south side of things, you tend to be at a different angle of the sun. So looking for more wider leaf cultivars and staying away from the narrow leaf cultivars is also going to be, again, more behoove you in terms of maximizing the amount of energy coming in on those plants. And then the other thing I'd recommend too, if you're in a colder area that does get cold, for the same reason that I just said about one of those wider leaves, CBD production is also higher with those more blue spectrum regions. So you're going to get higher CBD potential growing that cultivar, all things considered equal,
wow,
in Canada than I would in Jamaica. So if you're at a higher or ultra low latitude, CBD is going to be much easier for you to produce. Your THC expression is going to be slightly less because of that lower red in the light spectrum of the sun, because of the way that the atmosphere filters it out.
Man,
that's why it's kind of goofy to me to see these equatorial countries trying to do CBD production, because without totally turning off that gene completely, it's really hard to be at European certified at equatorial latitudes. I mean, it can be done, but it's real, real hard.
Wow, man, that's insane. I had no idea that that spectrum had so much impact on the CBD, or really any. Well, I guess, I mean, I get the cannabinoid production, but the CBD, that's interesting. I had never heard that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, if you want to increase your CBD, you don't want a lot of UVB or UVA on your grow. You want to have less UV for your CBD production, because that UV also helps increase that THC production and reduce the CBD production. Again, it's not going to totally change the plant completely, but it will.
Right.
If you're aiming at 0.3 or 0.2%, you know, it might push you over.
Man, it's always such a pleasure hanging out with you. I just look up and we're at the top of the hour here. Unfortunately, we do have a hard out, as they say in the radio industry, which is something I'm not a part of. Thank you for coming on the show, Steve. I do appreciate you, buddy.
Yep, thanks for having me. And if people want more information, they can check me out over on the Growing with Fishes podcast on their favorite podcast app. We're also on Amazon and YouTube Music now, and on Spotify and all the things. You can also check out the second annual virtual aquaponic cannabis conference on the second weekend of November on the Potaponics YouTube channel. We have a super cool lineup of guests this year, commercial growers from around the world, including the only commercial aquaponic cannabis grower from Bangladesh, and a couple of other really cool guests.
Whoa.
So super stoked on that. And we also have the online aquaponic cannabis masterclass with Marty. Again, use coupon code GROWCAST for a big discount on the class. So check that out at apmjclass.com. We have hundreds of hours of content on there, and constantly adding new slides, new microscope work, new reference guides every month, and live sessions as well. So thanks a lot for having me. And look forward to coming on again soon.
It's always hard to wind them down. We should just make a bigger block, maybe do an extravaganza or something. We'll figure something out, man. I want to come down to Oklahoma. We'll do some live content together. I got to make sure that you're going to be there at the time that I schedule the trip. So we'll be in touch, you and I.
Oh yeah, we'll have a blast.
Look forward to that, everybody. It's going to be fucking awesome. All right, that's all for tonight. For today, whenever you're listening to this, dear listener, thank you for tuning in. This is Steven Reisner and Jordan River signing off, saying be safe out there, everybody, and grow smarter. That's our show. Thank you so much for tuning in, all of you. Thank you again to Steven Reisner. What a great friend of GrowCast, and what a great guest. Be sure to check out our membership. He's been on GrowCast TV before. He did a great episode live with us on video, and he'll be back on again. So for more Steven Reisner, be sure to hit that member portal at patreon.com/growcast. Quick shout out to the Foop before we wrap it up. FoopCanna.com is where you can find them. Really, really happy to be partnered with these guys. Organic
bottled nutrients made from fish waste. And go and get in on the giveaway, everybody. That's what I really want to urge you to do today. Go to growcastpodcast.com/foop to get in on this giveaway. Every single week, they're giving away a starter pack. They're giving away clone gel. They're giving away mist. The new Foop mist is awesome. Keep an eye out for that. Has that dropped yet? I don't know. They're letting Growcast in on a little bit of a trial run. And I think they're about to release this thing. They've been letting us test it. And I got to tell you, it's a really, really incredible foliar product. I'm only using two products in foliar, and that's one of them. Love this stuff, the Foop Mist. Anyways, be sure to get in on the giveaway. Every single week you can enter by going to growcastpodcast.com/Foop. Thank you to the Foop for being such amazing sponsors and supporters of the cannabis industry. All right, everybody. I think that's it for today. Yeah, that does it. Of course, shout out to Jay Blank for doing the ad beat. Shout out to Illinois Canna Consulting for all of your consulting needs. That's Rich's consulting company. And shout out to all of the members. Thank you so much for being part of membership. And thank you, listeners, too. Of course, I appreciate you tuning in, downloading the show, staying subscribed. Cannot express my gratitude properly. Thank you. Thank you all. All right, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.